McGee, Rainbird said, and Dr. Wanless began to speak. His words came slowly at first, and then he began to speed up. He talked. He gave Rainbird the complete history of the Lot 6 tests and the climactic experiment. Much of what he said Rainbird already knew, but Wanless also filled in a number of blank spots. The professor went through the entire sermon he had given Cap that morning, and here it did not fall on deaf ears. Rainbird listened carefully, frowning sometimes, clapping softly and chuckling at Wanless's toilet training metaphor. This encouraged Wanless to speak even faster, and when he began to repeat himself, as old men will, Rainbird reached down again, pinched Wanless's nose shut with one hand again, and covered his mouth with the other again. "Sorry," Rainbird said. Wanless bucked and sun-faced under Rainbird's weight. Rainbird applied more pressure, and when Wanless's struggles began to lessen, Rainbird abruptly removed the hand he had been using to pinch Wanless's nose shut. The sound of the good doctor's hissing breath was like air escaping from a tire with a big nail in it. His eyes were rolling wildly in their sockets, rolling like the eyes of a fear-maddened horse, but they were still too hard to see. Rainbird seized the collar of Dr. Wanless's pajama jacket and yanked him sideways on the bed so that the cold white light from the bathroom shone directly across his face. Then he pinched the doctor's nostrils closed again. A man can sometimes survive for upward of 9 minutes without permanent brain damage if his air is cut off and he remains completely quiet. A woman with slightly greater lung capacity and a slightly more efficient carbon dioxide disposal system may last 10 or 12. Of course, struggling and terror cuts that survival time a great deal. Dr. Wanless struggled briskly for 40 seconds, and then his efforts to save himself began to flag. His hands beat lightly at the twisted granite that was John Rainbird's face. His heels drummed a muffled retreat tattoo on the carpeting. He began to drool against Rainbird's calloused palm. This was the moment. Rainbird leaned forward and studied Wanless's eyes with a childlike eagerness. But it was the same. Always the same. The eyes seemed to lose their fear and fill instead with a great puzzlement. Not wonder, not dawning comprehension or realization or awe, just puzzlement. For a moment, those two puzzled eyes fixed on John Rainbird's one, and Rainbird knew he was being seen. Fuzzily, perhaps, fading back and back as the doctor went out and out. But he was being seen. Then there was nothing but glaze. Dr. Joseph Wanless was no longer staying at the Mayflower Hotel. Rainbird was sitting on this bed with a life-size doll. He sat still, one hand still over the doll's mouth, the other pinching the doll's nostrils tightly together. It was best to be sure. He would remain so for another 10 minutes. He thought about what Wanless had told him concerning Charlene McGee. Was it possible that a small child could have such a power? He supposed it might be. In Calcutta, he had seen a man put knives into his body, his legs, his belly, his chest, his neck, and then pull them out, leaving no wounds. It might be possible, and it was certainly interesting. He thought about these things, and then found himself wondering what it would be like to kill a child. He had never knowingly done such a thing, although once he had placed a bomb on an airliner and the bomb had exploded, killing all 67 aboard, and perhaps one or more of them had been children. But that was not the same thing. It was impersonal. It was not a business in which the death of children was often required. They were not, after all, some terrorist organization like the IRA or the PLO. No matter how much some people, some of the yellow bellies in the Congress, for instance, would like to believe they were. They were, after all, a scientific organization. Perhaps with a child the result would be different. There might be another expression in the eyes at the end, something besides the puzzlement that made him feel so empty and so, yes, it was true, so sad. He might discover part of what he needed to know in the death of a child like this Charlene McGee. "My life is like the straight roads in a desert," John Rainbird said softly. He looked absorbedly into the dull blue marbles that had been the eyes of Dr. Wanless. But your life is no road at all, my friend. My good friend. He kissed Wanless first on one cheek and then on the other. Then he pulled him back onto the bed and threw a sheet over him. It came down softly like a parachute and outlined Wanless's jutting and now tideless nose in white lawn. Rainbird left the room. That night he thought about the girl who could supposedly light fires. He thought about her a great deal. He wondered where she was, what she was thinking, what she was dreaming. He felt very tender about her, very protective. By the time he drifted off to sleep at just past 6 a.m., he was sure. The girl would be his. Tashmore, Vermont. 1. Andy and Charlie McGee arrived at the cottage on Tashmore Pond 2 days after the burning at the Manders farm. The Willies hadn't been in great shape to start with, and the muddy plunge over the woods roads that Irv had directed them onto had done little to improve it. When dusk came on the endless day that had begun in Hastings Glen, they had been less than 20 yards from the end of the second and worse of the two woods roads. Below them, but screened off by a heavy growth of bushes, was Route 22. Although they couldn't see the road, they could hear the occasional swish and whine of passing cars and trucks. They slept that night in the Willies, bundled up for warmth. They set out again the next morning, yesterday morning, at just past 5 a.m., with daylight nothing but a faint white tone in the east. Charlie looked pallid and listless and used up. She hadn't asked him what would happen to them if the roadblocks had been shifted east. It was just as well, because if the roadblocks had been shifted, they would be caught, and that was simply all there was to it. There was no question of ditching the Willies, either. Charlie was in no shape to walk, and for that matter, neither was he. So Andy had pulled onto the highway, and all that day in October, they had jigged and jogged along secondary roads under a white sky that promised rain but never quite delivered it. Charlie slept a great deal, and Andy worried about her, worried that she was using the sleep in an unhealthy way, using it to flee what had happened instead of trying to come to terms with it. He stopped twice at roadside diners and picked up burgers and fries. The second time he used the $5 bill that the van driver, Jim Paulson, had laid on him. Most of the remaining phone change was gone. He must have lost some of it out of his pockets during that crazy time at the Manders place, but he didn't recall it. Something else was gone as well. Those frightening numb places on his face had faded away sometime during the night. Those he didn't mind losing. Most of Charlie's share of the burgers and fries went uneaten. Last night he had driven into a highway rest area about an hour after dark. The rest area was deserted. It was autumn, and the season of the Winnebagoes had passed for another year. A rustic wood-burned sign read, "No camping, no fires, leash your dog, $500 fine for littering." "They're real sports around here," Andy muttered, and drove the Willies down the slope beyond the far edge of the gravel parking lot and into a copse beside a small chuckling stream. He and Charlie got out and went wordlessly down to the water. The overcast held, but it was mild. There were no stars visible, and the night seemed extraordinarily dark. They sat down for a while and listened to the brook tell its tale. He took Charlie's hand, and that was when she began to cry, great tearing sobs that seemed to be trying to rip her apart. He took her in his arms and rocked her. "Charlie," he murmured. "Charlie, Charlie, don't cry." "Please don't make me do it again, Daddy," she wept. "Because if you said to, I'd do it, and then I guess I'd kill myself, so please, please, never—" "I love you," he said. "Be quiet and stop talking about killing yourself. That's crazy talk." "No," she said, "it isn't. Promise, Daddy." He thought for a long time and then said slowly, "I don't know if I can, Charlie, but I promise to try. Will that be good enough?" Her troubled silence was answer enough. "I get scared, too," he said softly. "Daddy's get scared, too. You better believe it." They spent that night, too, in the cab of the Willies. They were back on the road by 6 o'clock in the morning. The clouds had broken up, and by 10 o'clock it had become a flawless Indian summery day. Not long after they crossed the Vermont state line, they saw men riding ladders like masts in tossing apple trees, and trucks in the orchards filled with bushel baskets of Macs. At 11:30, they turned off Route 34 and onto a narrow, rutted dirt road marked Private Property. And something in Andy's chest loosened. They had made it to Grand'ther McGee's place. They were here. They drove slowly down toward the pond, a distance of perhaps a mile and a half. October leaves, red and gold, swirled across the road in front of the Jeep's blunt nose. Just as glints of water began to show through the trees, the road branched in two. A heavy steel chain hung across the smaller branch, and from the chain a rust-flecked yellow sign. No trespassing by order of county sheriff. Most of the rust flecks had formed around six or eight dimples in the metal, and Andy guessed that some summer kid had spent a few minutes working off his boredom by plinking at the sign with his .22. But that had been years ago. He got out of the Willys and took his key ring out of his pocket. There was a leather tab on the ring with his initials, A. McGee, almost obliterated. Vicky had given him that piece of leather for Christmas one year, a Christmas before Charlie had been born. He stood by the chain for a moment, looking at the leather tab, then at the keys themselves. There were almost two dozen of them. Keys were funny things. You could index a life by the keys that had a way of collecting on your key ring. He supposed that some people, undoubtedly people who had realized a higher degree of organization than he had, simply threw their old keys away, just as those same organizational types made a habit of cleaning their wallets out every 6 months or so. Andy had never done either. Here was the key that opened the east wing door of Prince Hall back in Harrison, where his office had been. His key to the office itself, to the English Department office. Here was the key to the house in Harrison that he had seen for the last time on the day the shop killed his wife and kidnapped his daughter. Two or three more he couldn't even identify. Keys were funny things, all right. His vision blurred. Suddenly he missed Vicky, and needed her as he hadn't needed her since those first black weeks on the road with Charlie. He was so tired, so scared, and so full of anger. In that moment, if he'd had every employee of the shop lined up in front of him along Grand'ther's Road, and if someone had handed him a Thompson submachine gun... "Daddy?" It was Charlie's voice, anxious. "Can't you find the key?" "Yes, I've got it," he said. It was among the rest, a small Yale key on which he had scratched TP for Tashmore Pond with his jackknife. The last time they had been here was the year Charlie was born, and now Andy had to wiggle the key a little before the stiff tumblers would turn. Then the lock popped open, and he had laid the chain down on the carpet of fall leaves. He drove the Willys through and then re-padlocked the chain. The road was in bad shape, Andy was glad to see. When they came up regularly every summer, they would stay 3 or 4 weeks, and he would always find a couple of days to work on the road, get a load of gravel from Sam Moore's gravel pit and put it down in the worst of the ruts, cut back the brush, and get Sam himself to come down with his old dragger and even it out. The camp road's other broader fork led down to almost two dozen camp homes and cottages strung along the shorefront, and those folks had their road association, annual dues, August business meeting and all, although the business meeting was really only an excuse to get really loaded before Labor Day came and put an end to another summer. But Grand'ther's place was the only one down this way, because Grand'ther himself had bought all the land for a song back in the depths of the Depression. In the old days, they'd had a family car, a Ford wagon. He doubted if the old wagon would have made it down here now, and even the Willys, with its high axles, bottomed out once or twice. And he didn't mind at all. It meant that no one had been down here. "Will there be electricity, Daddy?" Charlie asked. "No," he said, "and no phone either. We don't dare get the electricity turned on, kiddo. It'd be like holding up a sign saying, 'Here we are.' But there are kerosene lamps and two range oil drums. If the stuff hasn't been ripped off, that is." That worried him a little. Since the last time they'd been down here, the price of range oil had gone up enough to make the theft worthwhile, he supposed. "Will there be..." Charlie began. "Holy shit," Andy said. He jammed on the brakes. A tree had fallen across the road up ahead, a big old birch pushed down by some winter storm. "I guess we walk from here. It's only a mile or so anyway. We'll hike it." Later he would have to come back with Grand'ther's one-handed buck and cut the tree up. He didn't want to leave Irv's Willys parked here. It was too open. He ruffled her hair. Come on. They got out of the willies, and Charlie scooted effortlessly under the birch, while Andy clambered carefully over, trying not to skewer himself anywhere important. The leaves crunched agreeably under their feet as they walked on, and the woods were aromatic with fall. A squirrel looked down at them from a tree, watching their progress closely. And now they began to see bright slices of blue again through the trees. "What did you start to say back there when we came to the tree?" Andy asked her. "If there would be enough oil for a long time, in case we stay the winter." "No, but there's enough to start with, and I'm going to cut a lot of wood. You will haul plenty of it, too." 10 minutes later, the road widened into a clearing on the shore of Tashmore Pond, and they were there. They both stood quietly for a moment. Andy didn't know what Charlie was feeling, but for him there was a rush of remembrance too total to be called anything so mild as nostalgia. Mixed up in the memories was his dream of 3 mornings ago, the boat, the squirming nightcrawler, even the tire patches on Granther's boots. The cottage was 5 rooms, wood over a fieldstone base. A deck jutted out toward the lake, and a stone pier poked out into the water itself. Except for the drifts of leaves and the blowdowns of 3 winters, the place hadn't changed a bit. He almost expected Granther himself to come strolling out, wearing one of those green and black checked shirts, waving and bellowing for him to come on up, asking him if he'd got his fishing license yet, because the brown trout were still biting good around dusk. It had been a good place, a safe place. Far across Tashmore Pond, the pines glimmered gray-green in the sunshine. "Stupid trees," Granther had said once. "Don't even know the difference between summer and winter." The only sign of civilization on the far side was still the Bradford town landing. No one had put up a shopping center or an amusement park. The wind still talked in the trees here. The green shingles still had a mossy, woodsy look, and pine needles still drifted in the roof angles and in the cup of the wooden gutter. He had been a boy here, and Granther had shown him how to bait a hook. He had had his own bedroom here, paneled in good maple, and he had dreamed of boys' dreams in a narrow bed, and had awakened to the sound of water lapping the pier. He had been a man here as well, making love to his wife in the double bed that had once belonged to Granther and his wife. That silent and somehow baleful woman who was a member of the American Society of Atheists, and would explain to you, should you ask, the 30 greatest inconsistencies in the King James Bible. Or, should you prefer, the laughable fallacy of the clock spring theory of the universe, all with the thudding, irrevocable logic of a dedicated preacher. "You miss Mom, don't you?" Charlie said in a forlorn voice. "Yeah," he said. "Yeah, I do." "Me too," Charlie said. "You had fun here, didn't you?" "We did," he agreed. "Come on, Charlie." She held back, looking at him. "Daddy, will things ever be all right for us again? Will I be able to go to school and things?" He considered a lie, but a lie was a poor answer. "I don't know," he said. He tried to smile, but it wouldn't come. He found he could not even stretch his lips convincingly. "I don't know, Charlie." 2. Granther's tools were all still neatly racked in the tool shed portion of the boathouse, and Andy found a bonus he had hoped for, but had told himself not to hope for too much. Nearly 2 cords of wood, neatly split and time-seasoned in the bay beneath the boathouse. Most of it he had split himself, and it was still under the sheet of ragged, dirty canvas he had thrown over it. 2 cords wouldn't take them through the winter, but by the time he finished carving up the blowdowns around the camp and the birch back on the road, they would be well set. He took the bucksaw back up to the fallen tree and cut it up enough to get the willies through. By then it was nearly dark, and he was tired and hungry. No one had bothered to rip off the well-stocked pantry either. If there had been vandals or thieves or snowmobiles over the last 6 winters, they had stuck to the more populous southern end of the lake. There were 5 shelves packed with Campbell's soups and Wyman's sardines and Dintymoor beef stew and all sorts of canned vegetables. There was also still 1/2 case of Rival dog food on the floor, a legacy of Granther's good old dog Bimbo. But Andy didn't think it would come to that. While Charlie looked at the books on the shelves in the big living room, Andy went into the small root cellar that was three steps down from the pantry, scratched a wooden match on one of the beams, stuck his finger into the knot hole in one of the boards that lined the sides of the little dirt-floored room, and pulled. The board came out, and Andy looked inside. After a moment, he grinned. Inside the cobweb-festooned little bolt hole were four mason jars filled with a clear, slightly oily-looking liquid that was 100% pure white lightning, what Granther called Father's Mule Kick. The match burned Andy's fingers. He shook it out and lit a second. Like the Dour New England preachers of old, from whom he had been a direct descendant, Huldah McGee had no liking, understanding, or tolerance for the simple and slightly stupid male pleasures. She had been a Puritan atheist, and this had been Granther's little secret, which he had shared with Andy the year before he died. Besides the white lightning, there was a caddy for poker chips. Andy pulled it out and felt in the slot at the top. There was a crackling sound, and he pulled out a thin sheaf of bills, a few tens and fives and some ones, maybe $80 all told. Granther's weakness had been seven-card stud, and this was what he called his strutting money. The second match burned his fingers, and Andy shook it out. Working in the dark, he put the poker chips back, money and all. It was good to know it was there. He replaced the board and went back through the pantry. "Tomato soup, do you?" he asked Charlie. Wonder of wonders, she had found all the Pooh books on one of the shelves and was currently somewhere in the 100-acre wood with Pooh and Eeyore. "Sure," she said, not looking up. He made a big pot of tomato soup and opened them each a tin of sardines. He lit one of the kerosene lamps after carefully drawing the drapes and put it in the middle of the dining table. They sat down and ate, neither of them talking much. Afterward, he smoked a cigarette, lighting it over the chimney of the lamp. Charlie discovered the card drawer in Grandma's Welsh dresser. There were eight or nine decks in there, each of them missing a jack or a deuce or something, and she spent the rest of the evening sorting them and playing with them, while Andy prowled through the camp. Later, tucking her into bed, he asked her how she felt. "Safe," she said with no hesitation at all. "Good night, Daddy." If it was good enough for Charlie, it was good enough for him. He sat with her a while, but she dropped off to sleep quickly and with no trouble, and he left after propping her door open so he would hear her if she became restless in the night. 3. Before turning in, Andy went back down to the root cellar, got one of the jars of white lightning, poured himself a small knock and a juice glass, and went out through the sliding door and onto the deck. He sat in one of the canvas director's chairs. Mildewy smell. He wondered briefly if something could be done about that, and looked out at the dark, moving bulk of the lake. It was a trifle chilly, but a couple of small sips at Granther's Mule Kick took care of the chill quite nicely. For the first time since that terrible chase up Third Avenue, he too felt safe and at rest. He smoked and looked out across Tashmore Pond. Safe and at rest, but not for the first time since New York City. For the first time since the shop had come back into their lives on that terrible August day 14 months ago. Since then, they had either been running or hunkering down, and either way, there was no rest. He remembered talking to Quincy on the telephone with the smell of burned carpeting in his nostrils. He in Ohio, Quincy out there in California, which in his few letters he always called the Magic Earthquake Kingdom. "Yes, it's a good thing," Quincy had said. "Or they might put them in two little rooms where they could work full-time to keep 220 million Americans safe and free. I bet they'd just want to take that child and put it in a little room and see if it could help make the world safe for democracy. And I think that's all I want to say, old buddy, except keep your head down." He thought he had been scared then. He hadn't known what scared was. Scared was coming home and finding your wife dead with her fingernails pulled out. They had pulled out her nails to find out where Charlie was. Charlie had been spending 2 days and two nights at her friend Terry Dugan's house. A month or so later, they had been planning to have Terry over to their house for a similar length of time. Vicky had called it the Great Swap of 1980. Now, sitting on the deck and smoking, Andy could reconstruct what had happened, although then he had existed in nothing but a blur of grief and panic and rage. It had been the blindest good luck, or perhaps a little more than luck, that had enabled him to catch up with them at all. They had been under surveillance, the whole family. Must have been for some time. And when Charlie hadn't come home from summer day camp that Wednesday afternoon, and didn't show up on Thursday or Thursday evening either, they must have decided that Andy and Vicky had tumbled to the surveillance. Instead of discovering that Charlie was doing no more than staying at a friend's house not 2 miles away, they must have decided that they had taken their daughter and gone underground. It was a crazy, stupid mistake, but it hadn't been the first such on the shop's part. According to an article Andy had read in Rolling Stone, the shop had been involved and heavily influential in precipitating a bloodbath over an airplane hijacking by Red Army terrorists. The hijack had been aborted at the cost of 60 lives. In selling heroin to the organization in return for information on mostly harmless Cuban-American groups in Miami, and in the communist takeover of a Caribbean island that had once been known for its multimillion-dollar beachfront hotels and its voodoo-practicing population. With such a series of colossal gaffes under the shop's belt, it became less difficult to understand how the agents employed to keep watch on the McGee family could mistake a child's 2 nights at a friend's house as a run for the tall timber. As Quincy would have said, and maybe he had, if the most efficient of the shop's 1,000 or more employees had to go to work in the private sector, they would have been drawing unemployment benefits before their probationary periods were up. But there had been crazy mistakes on both sides, Andy reflected. And if the bitterness in that thought had become slightly vague and diffuse with the passage of time, it had once been sharp enough to draw blood, a many-tined bitterness, with each sharp point tipped with the curare of guilt. He had been scared by the things Quincy implied on the phone that day Charlie tripped and fell down the stairs. But apparently he hadn't been scared enough. If he had been, perhaps they would have gone underground. He had discovered too late that the human mind can become hypnotized when a life, or the life of a family, begins to drift out of the normal range of things and into a fervid fantasy land that you are usually asked to accept only in 60-minute bursts on TV, or maybe for 110-minute sittings in the local Cinema One. In the wake of his conversation with Quincy, a peculiar feeling had gradually crept over him. It began to seem that he was constantly stoned. A tap on his phone? People watching them? A possibility that they might all be scooped up and dropped into the basement rooms of some government complex? There was such a tendency to smile a silly smile and just watch these things loom up. Such a tendency to do the civilized thing and poo-poo your own instincts. Out on Tashmore Pond, there was a sudden dark flurry, and a number of ducks took off into the night, headed west. A half-moon was rising, casting a dull silver glow across their wings as they went. Andy lit another cigarette. He was smoking too much, but he would get a chance to go cold turkey soon enough. He had only 4 or 5 left. Yes, he had suspected there was a tap on the phone. Sometimes there would be an odd double click after you picked it up and said hello. Once or twice when he had been talking to a student who had called to ask about an assignment or to one of his colleagues, the connection had been mysteriously broken. He had suspected that there might be bugs in the house, but he had never torn the place apart looking for them. Had he suspected he might find them? And several times he had suspected, no, had been almost sure, that they were being watched. They had lived in the Lakeland district of Harrison, and Lakeland was the sublime archetype of suburbia. On a drunk night, you could circle 6 or 8 blocks for hours just looking for your own house. The people who were their neighbors worked for the IBM plant outside town, Ohio Semiconductor in town, or taught at the college. You could have drawn 2 ruler straight lines across an average family income sheet, the lower line at 18,500, and the upper one at maybe 30,000, and almost everyone in Lakeland would have fallen in the area between. You got to know people. You nodded on the street to Mrs. Bacon, who had lost her husband and had since been remarried to vodka, and she looked it. The honeymoon with that particular gentleman was playing hell with her face and figure. You tipped a V at the 2 girls with the white jag who were renting the house on the corner of Jasmine Street and Lakeland Avenue, and wondered what spending the night with the 2 of them would be like. You talked baseball with Mr. Hammond on Laurel Lane as he everlastingly trimmed his hedges. Mr. Hammond was with IBM, which stands for I've been moved, he would tell you endlessly as the electric clippers hummed and buzzed, originally from Atlanta and a rabid Atlanta Braves fan. He loathed Cincinnati's big red machine, which did not exactly endear him to the neighborhood. Not that Hammond gave a shit. He was just waiting for IBM to hand him a fresh set of walking papers. But Mr. Hammond was not the point. Mrs. Bacon wasn't the point. Nor were those two luscious peaches and their white Jag with the dull red primer paint around the headlights. The point was that after a while your brain formed its own subconscious subset. People who belong in Lakeland. But in the months before Vicky was killed and Charlie snatched from the Dugan's house, there had been people around who didn't belong to that subset. Andy had dismissed them, telling himself it would be foolish to alarm Vicky just because talking to Quincy had made him paranoid. The people in the light gray van, the man with the red hair that he had seen slouched behind the wheel of an AMC Matador one night, and then behind the wheel of a Plymouth Arrow one night about 2 weeks later, and then in the shotgun seat of the gray van about 10 days after that. Too many salesmen came to call. There had been evenings when they had come home from a day out, or from taking Charlie to see the latest Disney epic, when he had got the feeling that someone had been in the house, that things had been moved around the tiniest bit. That feeling of being watched. But he hadn't believed it would go any further than watching. That had been his crazy mistake. He was still not entirely convinced that it had been a case of panic on their part. They might have been planning to snatch Charlie and himself, killing Vicky because she was relatively useless. Who really needed a low-grade psychic whose big trick for the week was closing the refrigerator door from across the room? Nevertheless, the job had a reckless hurry-up quality to it that made him think that Charlie's surprise disappearance had made them move more quickly than they had intended. They might have waited if it had been Andy who dropped out of sight, but it hadn't been. It had been Charlie, and she was the one they were really interested in. Andy was sure of that now. He got up and stretched, listening to the bones in his spine crackle. Time he went to bed, time he stopped hashing over these old hurtful memories. He was not going to spend the rest of his life blaming himself for Vicky's death. He had only been an accessory before the fact, after all. And the rest of his life might not be that long, either. The action on Irv Mander's porch hadn't been lost on Andy McGee. They had meant to waste him. It was only Charlie they wanted now. He went to bed, and after a while he slept. His dreams were not easy ones. Over and over he saw that trench of fire running across the beaten dirt of the dooryard, saw it divide to make a fairy ring around the chopping block, saw the chickens going up like living incendiaries. In the dream he felt the heat capsule around him, building and building. She said she wasn't going to make fires anymore. And maybe that was best. Outside, the cold October moon shone down on Tashmore Pond, on Bradford, New Hampshire, across the water, and on the rest of New England. To the south, it shone down on Longmont, Virginia. 4. Sometimes Andy McGee had feelings, hunches of extraordinary vividness. Ever since the experiment in Jason Gearney Hall, he didn't know if the hunches were a low-grade sort of precognition or not, but he had learned to trust them when he got them. Around noon on that August day in 1980, he got a bad one. It began during lunch in the Buckeye Room, the faculty lounge on the top floor of the Union Building. He could even pinpoint the exact moment. He'd been having cream chicken on rice with Ev O'Brien, Bill Wallace, and Don Grabowski, all in the English department. Good friends, all of them. And as usual, someone had brought along a Polish joke for Don, who collected them. It had been Ev's joke, something about being able to tell a Polish ladder from a regular one because the Polish ladder had the word stop lettered on the top rung. All of them were laughing when a small, very calm voice spoke up in Andy's mind. Something's wrong at home. That was all. That was enough. It began to build up almost the same way that his headaches build up when he overused the push and tipped himself over. Only this wasn't a head thing. All his emotions seemed to be tangling themselves up, almost lazily, as if they were yarn and some bad-tempered cat had been let loose along the runs of his nervous system to play with them and snarl them up. He stopped feeling good. The creamed chicken lost whatever marginal appeal it had had to begin with. His stomach began to flutter, and his heart was beating rapidly, as if he had just had a bad scare. And then the fingers of his right hand began abruptly to throb, as if he had got them jammed in a door. Abruptly, he stood up. Cold sweat was breaking on his forehead. "Look, I don't feel so good," he said. "Can you take my 1 o'clock, Bill?" "Those aspiring poets? Sure, no problem. What's wrong?" "I don't know. Something I ate, maybe." "You look sort of pale," Don Grabowski said. "You ought to cruise over to the infirmary, Andy." "I may do that," Andy said. He left, but with no intention whatever of going to the infirmary. It was 12:15, the late summer campus drowsing through the last week of the final summer session. He raised a hand to Ev, Bill, and Don as he hurried out. He had not seen any of them since that day. He stopped on the union's lower level, let himself into a telephone booth, and called home. There was no answer. No real reason why there should have been. With Charlie at the Dugans, Vicky could have been out shopping, having her hair done. She could have been over at Tammy Upmore's house, or even having lunch with Eileen Bacon. Nevertheless, his nerves cranked up another notch. They were nearly screaming now. He left the union building and half-walked, half-ran to the station wagon, which was in the Prince Hall parking lot. He drove across town to Lakeland. His driving was jerky and poor. He jumped lights, tailgated, and came close to knocking a hippie off his 10-speed Olympia. The hippie gave him the finger. Andy barely noticed. His heart was trip-hammering now. He felt as if he had taken a hit of speed. They lived on Conifer Place. In Lakeland, as in so many suburban developments built in the 50s, most of the streets seemed named for trees or shrubs. In the midday August heat, the street seemed queerly deserted. It only added to his feeling that something bad had happened. The street looked wider with so few cars parked along the curbs. Even the few kids playing here and there could not dispel that strange feeling of desertion. Most of them were eating lunch or over at the playground. Mrs. Flynn from Laurel Lane walked past with a bag of groceries in a wheeled caddy, her paunch as round and tight as a soccer ball under her avocado-colored stretch pants. All up and down the street, lawn sprinklers twirled lazily, fanning water onto the grass and rainbows into the air. Andy drove the offside wheels of the wagon up over the curb and then slammed on the brakes hard enough to lock his seatbelt momentarily and to make the wagon's nose dip toward the pavement. He turned off the engine, with the gear shift still in drive, something he never did, and went up the cracked cement walk that he kept meaning to patch and somehow never seemed to get around to. His heels clacked meaninglessly. He noticed that the Venetian blind over the big living room picture window. "Mural window," the realtor who had sold him the house called it. "Here you got your basic mural window," was drawn, giving the house a closed, secretive aspect he didn't like. Did she usually pull the blind? To keep as much of the summer heat out as possible, maybe? He didn't know. He realized there were a great many things he didn't know about her life when he was away. He reached for the doorknob, but it didn't turn. It only slipped through his fingers. Did she lock the door when he was gone? He didn't believe it. That wasn't Vicky. His worry, no, it was terror now, increased. And yet there was one moment, which he would never admit to himself later, one small moment when he felt nothing but an urge to turn away from that locked door. Just hightail it. Never mind Vicky or Charlie or the weak justifications that would come later. Just run. Instead, he groped in his pocket for his keys. In his nervousness, he dropped them and had to bend to pick them up. Car keys. The key to the east wing of Prince Hall. The blackish key that unlocked the chain he put across Granther's Road at the end of each summer visit. Keys had a funny way of accumulating. He plucked his house key from the bunch and unlocked the door. He went in and shut it behind him. The light in the living room was a low, sick yellow. It was hot and still. Oh, God, it was so still. Vicky? No answer. And all that no answer meant was that she wasn't here. She had put on her boogie shoes, as she liked to say, and had gone marketing or visiting. Except that she wasn't doing either of those things. He felt sure of it. And his hand, his right hand, why were the fingers throbbing so? Vicky! He went into the kitchen. There was a small formica table out there with three chairs. He and Vicky and Charlie usually ate their breakfast in the kitchen. One of the chairs now lay on its side like a dead dog. The salt shaker had overturned and salt was spilled across the table's surface. Without thinking what he was doing, Andy pinched some of it between the thumb and first finger of his left hand and tossed it back over his shoulder, muttering under his breath, as both his father and his grandfather had done before him. Salt, salt, malt, malt, bad luck, stay away. There was a pot of soup on the hot point. It was cold. The empty soup can stood on the counter. Lunch for one. But where was she? Vicky! He hollered down the stairs. Dark down there. The laundry room and the family room, which ran the length of the house. No answer. He looked around the kitchen again, neat and tidy. Two of Charlie's drawings, made at the vacation Bible school she had attended in July, held on the refrigerator with small plastic vegetables that had magnetic bases. An electric bill and a phone bill stuck on the spike with the motto, "Pay these last," written across the base. Everything in its place, and a place for everything. Except the chair was overturned. Except the salt was spilled. There was no spit in his mouth, none at all. His mouth was as dry and slick as chrome on a summer day. Andy went upstairs, looked through Charlie's room, their room, the guest room. Nothing. He went back through the kitchen, flicked on the stairway light, and went downstairs. Their Maytag washer gaped open. The dryer fixed him with one glassy porthole eye. Between them, on the wall, hung a sampler Vicky had bought somewhere. It read, "Honey, we're all washed up." He went into the family room and fumbled for the light switch, fingers brushing at the wall, crazily sure that at any moment unknown cold fingers would close over his and guide them to the switch. Then he found the plate at last, and the fluorescent bars, set into the Armstrong ceiling, glowed alive. This was a good room. He had spent a lot of time down here fixing things up, smiling at himself all the time because, in the end, he had become all those things that, as undergraduates, they had sworn they would not become. All three of them had spent a lot of time down here. There was a TV built into the wall, a ping-pong table, an oversized backgammon board. More board games were cased against one wall. There were some coffee-table-sized books ranged along a low table that Vicky had made from barn board. One wall had been dressed in paperbacks. Hung on the walls were several framed and matted Afghan squares that Vicky had knitted. She joked that she was great at individual squares, but simply didn't have the stamina to knit a whole damn blanket. There were Charlie's books in a special kid-sized bookcase, all of them carefully arranged in alphabetical order, which Andy had taught her one boring snowy night 2 winters before, and which still fascinated her. A good room. An empty room. He tried to feel relief. The premonition, hunch, whatever you wanted to call it, had been wrong. She just wasn't here. He snapped off the light and went back into the laundry room. The washing machine, a front loader they had picked up at a yard sale for $60, still gaped open. He shut it without thinking, much as he had tossed a pinch of the spilled salt over his shoulder. There was blood on the washer's glass window. Not much, only 3 or 4 drops. But it was blood. Andy stood staring at it. It was cooler down here. Too cool. It was like a morgue down here. He looked at the floor. There was more blood on the floor. It wasn't even dry. A little sound, a soft, squealing whisper, came from his throat. He began to walk around the laundry room, which was nothing but a small alcove with white plaster walls. He opened the clothes hamper. It was empty but for one sock. He looked in the cubbyhole under the sink. Nothing but less toil and tide and biz and spick and span. He looked under the stairs. Nothing there but cobwebs and the plastic leg of one of Charlie's older dolls, that dismembered limb lying patiently down here and waiting for rediscovery for God knew how long. He opened the door between the washer and the dryer, and the ironing board whistled down with a ratchet and a crash. And there beneath it, her legs tied up so that her knees were just below her chin, her eyes open and glazed and dead, was Vicky Tomlinson McGee with a cleaning rag stuffed in her mouth. There was a thick and sickening smell of Pledge furniture polish in the air. He made a low gagging noise and stumbled backward. His hands flailed, as if to drive this terrible vision away, and one of them struck the control panel of the dryer and it whirred into life. Clothes began to tumble and click inside. Andy screamed, and then he ran. He ran up the stairs and stumbled, going around the corner into the kitchen, and sprawled flat and bumped his forehead on the linoleum. He sat up, breathing hard.